All right, Marshall, go ahead and call the next case, please.
The next case is case number A231069, Les Grumdahl Window and Siding LLC versus Holly Brown.
And good morning, counsel. Today is March 6th. We're holding arguments via Zoom today. My name is Judge John Schmidt. I'm presiding. I'm here with Judge Sleater and Judge Klopaki. This will be recorded. And the audio will be available afterwards. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes, followed by 15 minutes for counsel for respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by the appellant's counsel. If you are not speaking, please go ahead and mute yourself so we don't have background noise. Counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may begin, and you can see the clock, hopefully on your screen, that has your time.
Thank you, Judge. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. My name, Your Honors, my name is Bill Paul. I'm an attorney from Duluth, and I represent Holly Brown. So that there's no confusion here, the relief that I am seeking on behalf of Holly Brown is twofold. First, I'm respectfully requesting that the pre-lien notice be declared invalid as a matter of law, because it did not comply with the pre-lien notice statute. And I will, of course, address that in a moment. The second claim for relief that I am seeking is that Holly Brown be granted a new trial based upon the irregularities in the trial process, specifically excusable neglect under Rule 60.02, judges, which provides that a court may relieve a party from a final judgment and order a new trial for the following reasons, colon, quote, mistake, inadvertence, surprise, or excusable neglect. I will take those in order. First off, the pre-lien notice. The district court judge decided that the pre-lien notice satisfied the pre-lien notice statute because it concluded it was part of a series of different contracts. Now, if such reasoning were allowed to exist, it would render the pre-lien notice statute meaningless. And what I mean by that is this. We all know that the mechanics lien statute is to be liberally construed. However, the pre-lien notice statute is to be technically construed, and that is there are technical requirements that need to be followed in order for there to be a proper and valid pre-lien notice. In this case, I respectfully submit that did not exist, and here is why.
Mr. Paul, can I ask about that in particular? The judge did, as you point out, I think multiple times, the original order, and then maybe in the memo, as I recall, denying a new trial, stated that the contract comprised five separate documents, the second of which, at least in chronology, was the letter that was sent to your client. The court found it was sent to your client, which gave the pre-lien notice. But I didn't see in your brief that you really argued the Anderson line of cases, the Anderson case, the one that was cited, and there's some before and after, because it cited that when multiple documents form a single transaction, that you consider them all together. And so what, as a matter of law, was how did the court err by in that statement? Because that does, in fact, seem by this record to be multiple documents that formed the one transaction, which was to make improvements on the house. And would you concede, if indeed that is correct, then the pre-lien statute is satisfied because the notice was in the contract?
I would, with all due respect, Your Honor, I would not concede that for the reasons that I alluded to earlier. Conceding that would, again, render meaningless the pre-lien notice statute. And here, let me explain why.
Thank you. That's what I was going to ask, why it would say.
Okay. The pre-lien notice statute requires that a pre-lien notice be contained in the contract itself. It is undisputed, Judge, that none of these three contracts contained a pre-lien notice. And so if it is not, if a pre-lien notice is not incorporated into the first contract, then Then the pre-lien notice is required to be sent separately within a finite period of time and can only be served by one of two ways, Judge, and that is by mail, certified mail, excuse me, and I don't know why I said mail, by certified mail or personal service. Now, it is undisputed that in this case, there is no evidence in this record that the pre-lien notice was sent by served by certified mail or personal service. Indeed, the evidence in this case reflects Les Grumdahl testified, "Well, I know my secretary sent it." This is a paraphrase, Judge. You can look at the transcript yourself. And of course, if I'm a little bit off, don't hold that against my client. I talked to my secretary about this yesterday, and she told me that Holly Brown called about it. Now, Holly Brown, Judge, denies ever getting a pre-lien notice or receiving one until the mechanic's lien statement was served upon her. Now, if a court, if a contractor is able to have a client enter into one contract and then a separate contract, neither of which contain a pre-lien notice, and then they send out in the mail, whether it's true or not, they send out in regular mail a pre-lien notice, then what's to stop a district court from listening to the contractor, like in this case, and saying, boy, he was really credible, he or she was really credible in saying that it was all part of one contract, and therefore the pre-lien notice is satisfied. That would happen.
Mr. Paul, I didn't see that's what the court found credible. Obviously, the court made credibility findings as to their testimony, including your client's denial of receiving, and the court found that not credible. But my question is, as a matter of law, which the court would have concluded, five documents formed a single contract. So you started your answer with three contracts did not, and I assume you're talking about the original contract and the change orders that were followed. But what is the error in the court's determination that there was a single contract comprised of five documents, the second of which was the pre-lien notice, which I assume you don't dispute satisfies the pre-lien notice in the sense of the terminology?
The terminology of the pre-lien notice was appropriate, but I would point out, Judge, the Merles case that I cite, of course, in my brief is smack on point. What the district court is not allowed to do is have a he said, she said, and in the absence of any affidavits of service in compliance with the statute, the pre-lien notice is automatically invalid as a matter of law. Now, I do not believe that a district court would then have the latitude to say, well, I'm going to find that when a contractor enters into a one contract, and then later on that contract is expanded to include doors or additional work, and then another one, and then another one, that all of those comprise a single contract, that would then allow a pre-lien notice to be served in the middle there that would then comply with the statute. That's all I can tell you, Judge. I think that would be an abuse of discretion and is an abuse of discretion as a matter of law to say, I'm going to conclude that all of these incorporate and make one series of contracts, and therefore the pre-lien notice, even though it was not sent and not included with any one of those, it was sent separately. And that's the key, Judge, I submit to you. The fact that it was sent separately and not with the contracts, that it is invalid. Is that responsive to your question, Judge?
It does. Thank you. Can I ask you a question actually on your second issue? It was your first issue. I kind of interrupted you, but I'm questioning how well a fit, Rule 60.02, and the Findon factors fits the facts of this case and the analysis. I understand. Well, first off, your client had a trial on the merits, and I understand your client's arguments about how much of the merits, but it was a trial on the merits on the case, whereas all the cases, the Findon et al. Cases are default judgment. But your basis is excusable attorney neglect. But when I look at the arguments, it's obviously your client's position. There was no good excuse. It was inexcusable neglect by the attorney, which led to your client's purported a disadvantage. And I didn't see any case law. Have you seen any case law that would apply a trial on the merits and an attorney's inexcusable neglect to support vacating a judgment following a merits trial?
Well, Judge, you and I have a fundamental difference of opinion about the trial on the merits. Judge Hilden, the district court judge, in response to a motion in limine brought by, and I'm going to answer your question, Judge. I'm not trying to avoid it here. There was a motion in limine brought on behalf of Les Grumdahl, served by respondent's counsel upon Rob Enslin. That motion in limine was not sent by respondent Les Grumdahl and its attorney to Holly Brown. It was sent to Holly Brown's prior counsel. Now, of course, we know that prior counsel did not respond to that motion in limine, thereby excluding all evidence that Holly Brown had in defense to the arguments made on behalf of respondent that Holly Brown breached the contract and didn't do this and didn't do that. So for respectfully, Judge, for you to suggest, to believe that there was a trial on the merits when all of her evidence was excluded pursuant to a motion in limine that wasn't served upon her, but was served upon her prior counsel, that when she's not allowed to introduce evidence other than oral testimony, no documents, no financial records, no proof of her damages, no nothing, that to me is not a trial on the merits. It was treated, Judge, in my view, as a motion for a default judgment. I cannot cite for you in the record, but I can, in respondent's brief, they say, you know, if you're not going to agree with me and you remand this, well, then you ought to remand it for the judge to consider a motion for a default judgment. That's troubling to me, Judge, because Holly Brown clearly served a pro se answer within 20 days of the date the complaint was served. And so for the respondent to say that she was completely, utterly in default is at a minimum misleading and at worst a misrepresentation to the court.
But isn't it true, Mr. Paul, that the basis for that was in fact the late presentation? In other words, she didn't even hire an attorney until after discovery deadline had expired and then was a late filing of whatever documents. And I think the answer by the attorney ultimately filed was the day before trial. So my question is, how would that be any abuse of discretion? The judge arguably could have proceeded in default, but allowed your client to testify, allowed her attorney to cross-examine the witnesses for the plaintiff, correct?
Well, yep, he did allow that, but it's a very narrow scope. And in my experience, and yours too, I'm sure, Judge, cases are to be resolved on the merits of the arguments by both parties. And so what we have here is Holly Brown, yes, she hired an attorney on November the 15th. That attorney represented to the court just prior to trial that he had just been represented, not true. The district court, quick aside, says, well, the pre-lien notice was signed by both parties, not true. The respondent's counsel says that Holly Brown never served an answer. Not true. All of these things, Judge, if those series of irregularities do not justify a Holly Brown being granted a motion for a new trial, I literally cannot think of a fact scenario by which an attorney is hired, does nothing until literally, I don't want to mislead, he filed a notice of appearance I think on February the 3rd or 4th, and then didn't file anything until the eve of trial. If that malfeasance on the part of an attorney can be condoned by the standard of review, is this an abuse of discretion? Well, then that's a sad state of affairs and a sad statement of our justice system in the state of Minnesota, Judge, with all due respect. Now,
counsel, I actually had a question for you about respondents. Counsel raises the issue of whether a pre-lien notice was ever required under these facts, given that there was no subcontractor. How do you respond to that?
Here's how I respond to that. Number one, Judge, it's as misleading as a suggestion that Holly Brown never served an answer on time. And here's why. If you look at the trial record, and I'm sure you do, I'm not implying remotely, Judge, that you're not, you will see invoices from Beacon. You will see that Les Grumdahl suggesting that he didn't employ subcontractors or material men or suppliers is, I'm using these, is ludicrous. He testified that there were materials that he ordered and was required to pay for, et cetera, et cetera. And I'd also point out that the judge in the trial judge, he didn't suggest that a pre-lien notice was not required. And on a very technical appellate issue, the respondent didn't file a notice of a cross notice of appeal on the issue of whether or not it was required to file a pre-lien notice because it didn't use any material men. So the bottom line is it purchased materials from suppliers in the form of windows, Judge, siding, all of this stuff. And there's extensive testimony about the siding, I believe, being at the supplier. And I cannot recall whether he indicated that he had paid for it or was going to pay for it in the future. But this is a classic case where a pre-lien notice was required, with in my view, without any doubt.
Thank you, counsel. That answered the question. I see your time has expired. You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal. So we'll turn to, if you could go ahead and mute yourself, and we'll go ahead and turn to respondents' counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Matt Hanka, and I'm one of the attorneys representing respondent Les Grumdahl Window and Siding in this matter. And I think the first thing I just want to point out is that the appellant did not file a reply brief. And so I just want the court to be aware that case law provides that any argument or authority that was not raised in that briefing shouldn't be considered. So to that extent, this court could almost consider our opposition brief to be unopposed. There are two issues on appeal, as appellant's counsel noted, the pre-lien notice and whether the trial court was correct to deny a motion for a new trial. It's our position, as you note through our briefing, that the district court's findings on both should be affirmed, again, for the reasons in our apparently unopposed brief. I'd also like to point out early here that there has been a distinct pattern in this case, and I think you can see that through the record. The appellant has missed deadlines, and that started way back during the contractual relationship the appellant had with my client. The contractual terms dictated that a second payment was due before work even was to start. That payment didn't come.
Also, I want to jump into the issue here about the pre-lien notice, because whether appellant missed deadlines or not doesn't get down to the whether your client served the pre-lien notice appropriately. So the idea, is there anything in the record that shows that this was served by certified mail or personal mail or personally served?
No, Your Honor. And I think we have three different reasons as to why a pre-lien notice was either adequate or not even required in this case. And if I can get into that, I'll cut to the chase. Number one, the pre-lien notice was given as part of a series of documents that made up the written contract. And as we've discussed, that's exactly what the trial court found And the evidence supports it. I haven't heard any case law opposing that finding that would tend to show that the trial court was wrong in that.
I haven't either, counsel, and I think the argument would have to be that it was clearly erroneous, that the district court clearly erred in that factual finding that was part of the contract. But I'd like to dig into that a little bit, because the Exhibit 8, which I believe is a pre-lien notice, says itself, we are providing this letter as a follow-up to the agreement we had reached regarding the above-described project. It seems to me that that is language that says we've already reached an agreement and here's a pre-lien notice that goes along with it. So how is that then incorporated in part of a contract if the agreement had already been reached?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons why it was incorporated. And the first being that the trial court found that it was incorporated. And I don't think that finding is clearly erroneous based on the evidence. But then again, as you note, that there was an original written proposal that was accepted, and it was actually the day later, Your Honor, that the written pre-lien notice was provided to the appellant, and it referenced that contract, as you note. But then importantly, and this is the second point I wanted to make, is that there were more written documents after that. There were addendums that define the scope of the work, which is very typical in a construction setting. Most of the time, you don't get everything right in the first proposal. But all of the written documents were ratified and agreed to by the appellant before any of the work started. All the documents were in writing. It was a series of documents that included the lien statement, as the trial court noted, and that all made up the contract. And in fact, if we look at the trial testimony, it was appellant herself testified that all the work contemplated by the series of writings were the contract. And that's specifically in the trial transcript. We noted this in our brief, pages 76 to 77. So she herself referred, as the trial court found, to the series of documents, including the pre-lien notice, as the contract. So we believe that the court's finding on the pre-lien notice was not clearly erroneous. I do kind of want to return to some of the other reasons we believe the pre-lien issue should be found in favor of our client, and that's the fact that the inadequacy of a pre-lien notice is an affirmative defense. And we've cited case law in our briefing that notes that, and recall that in this case, there was the appellant failed to timely and appropriately allege defenses to the complaint, and failed to respond to discovery until one day before trial. So really, we shouldn't even be considering whether there is an adequate pre-lien notice or not. That issue, those defenses, that affirmative defense was appropriately barred by the trial court through an order and a pretrial motion in limine. And that same argument should exist here. And that's just one of the three ways we think that the pre-lien notice issue should be found in favor of our client. And the third is, and we touched on this with appellant's counsel, that the pre-lien notice wasn't even required because respondent didn't use subcontractors or material suppliers, importantly, material suppliers who could place a lien on the property. So let's dig into that a little bit, if you're okay with it, Your Honor.
Mr. Hanska, before you do that, I'm going to jump to a separate question. It was raised by Mr. Paul, and I see it in the briefing and alluded to by the judge, that your client failed to serve an answer, or the answer was untimely, meaning the one that was prepared by her attorney that she ultimately hired. But how do you respond? And if you can explain to me that she apparently had already filed an answer pro se, would that not then no longer be a basis to exclude evidence if she actually did provide an answer? Although I did not find it in the record, but I saw a reference to it, and Mr. Paul referenced it too, and I maybe just missed it.
So, Your Honor, yes, thank you. What I believe is actually in the record was an email that I received that was essentially a request. And it should be in the record, but I'm going off memory here. It was essentially two lines, and it was requesting an extension to answer. It did not contain any defenses, which it did not contain any required affirmative defenses. And that's why I brought up the fact that the evidence on pre-lien notice was appropriately, should be appropriately precluded, because that is an affirmative defense that should have been pled through an answer. The only answer that had that defense was served on us a day before the trial. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
It does. But as to that point, just to clarify, she requested an extension. Was she granted that? But there was never actually an answer within what we describe as the normal timelines, or whatever extension that your client granted.
I don't believe we ever granted an extension I recall. It was just an email request that was sent to me.
It seems the plethora of law that I've seen, I did see the cases you referred to, but it seems like that a bit outlier, and maybe not even necessarily the holding in those cases. It seemed the plethora of the laws makes it pretty clear that a contractor must comply with the pre-lien notice. That would suggest to me that it's not an affirmative defense, but simply, and we've seen the cases, of course, where it's been reversed because it was not complied with. So would that not suggest that, and you would advise a contractor, in order before you can foreclose on it, you must comply with the pre-lien notice?
I do think compliance is obviously important, provided it's required under the facts of the case. And in this case, you know, we have an argument that notice was not required.
I understand that. I was actually going to the first point, presuming it was required, and I understand your argument as to how it was satisfied by the contract comprising the five documents. There was no clear error, but as to it seems to me the law suggests it's not an affirmative defense, but is an obligation before a foreclosure can occur. Isn't that not a correct statement of the law?
Well, we cited a couple cases in our briefing that say that pre-lien notice failure of pre-lien notice is a defense. And one of the cases was actually cited by the appellant, and that's the Berg case, 442 Northwest 2D300. And then we also cited another unpublished case from this court, from the Court of Appeals, called EH Earth Movers, 198 WL157351, that calls inadequate pre-lien notice specifically an affirmative defense. And that should be in our briefing, Your Honor.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I see my time's getting short, so I think I'd like to jump to the second appellate issue, if Your Honors are okay with that. And that is the point on the denied motion for a new trial. So what I heard here today, and what was in the appellant's briefing, is that they're relying on Rule 60.02 and Rule 5901 to support, both of those rules were relied upon in the prior motion and then also in this appeal. It was, as Your Honors are aware, the trial court denied that request. We don't think that was an abuse of discretion. There were detailed findings in the post-trial order memorandum dated June 16th, 2023, that found that neither rule applies. So, again, what I'm hearing today and through the briefing was that the main basis that appellant believes that there should be a new trial is because of some sort of attorney neglect. We didn't talk much about 5901 today, and in fact, appellant didn't cite any authority in the lower court or this appeal. So, 5901 we think should be knocked out as a viable basis for a new trial. 60.01, the trial court denied that request because that rule is not intended to provide a litigant with a second chance to litigate a case. And as Your Honors pointed out earlier, this was a case that there was a full trial on the merits. Certainly there were some constraints because of the conduct that occurred, through appellant waiting for almost a year to respond to discovery, waiting for almost the day before trial to file adequate alleged defenses and affirmative defenses. So that was all appropriate that there were these constraints, but regardless, there were full arguments, trial testimony, cross-examination, detailed post-trial briefing, in which really all the same arguments that we're talking about today were litigated. In the end, it was the trial court that didn't agree with her arguments. They found, as Your Honors also pointed out earlier, they found her testimony less credible than the respondents. And that's precisely the role of the fact finder. And the fact finder was correct. So under the new trial standard of 60.01, the appellant must show a reasonable claim on the merits, excuse for the neglect, due diligence after judgment, no substantial prejudice. That's what the case law says, the Hinz case that we talked about. That's what the case law says about excusable attorney neglect. But I mean, there's a number of reasons that we pointed out in our briefing, and I'll point out again here today as to why that fails.
Mr. Hancutt, it does seem in your briefing here and to the district court and the district court itself all seem to agree that the 60.02 and the case law Hinz, as you pointed out, Findon factors fits. So you're conceding that was the appropriate analysis the court should use, even though it was not a default judgment, but a trial on the merits.
Well, I think we do distinguish that, Your Honor, in our briefing. And that's one of the reasons why we think that the trial court was correct to deny it. Again, that was a default judgment. Our case, we have a full trial on the merits. But I can return to the first factor, and that was that the appellant failed on the merits. Appellant failed to pay, lien was valid, she breached the contract, and respondent proved damages. So under the first factor on the Hinz and Findon cases, she fails. You can't use Rule 60.02, and we cited a case of this effect, for a second chance to argue a fully litigated case. That's the Ayers case that we cited in our briefing. The record, and then also just very briefly, the record shows that the record shows that appellant can't show that alleged attorney malfeasance is what even caused her to lose. And I think you noted this, Your Honor. She didn't even retain her first attorney until long after the appropriate answer with affirmative defenses was due, and it was after the discovery deadline. We believe the trial court's order should be affirmed in total, Your Honors, and I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And the clock just got reset, so you may unmute and go ahead and start when you are ready.
Thank you for reminding me to unmute. It's always never automatic to me. A few points. Justice, you indicated that you did not find in the documents and answer that I alluded to in the first portion of my argument. I would direct your attention, Judge, to addendum 17 and 18 of appellant's addendum. It's on a caption that has the caption of the case. This was prepared pro se. You can read it. I don't want to take my time up. But it says in pertinent part, I absolutely deny these charges and challenge that Les Grumdahl fulfilled his contract. I plan on submitting a counterclaim when I can find an attorney. Thank you. That is dated this 30th day of January, 2022, signed Holly Brown. It does not say pro se. In this, at addendum page 18, Holly Brown included a certified tracker receipt from the post office indicating that response. And I would submit that is an answer that would not entitle the respondent to bring a motion for a default judgment on the allegation that she failed to answer. Number two.
Thank you, Mr. Paul, for that site. So just to clarify, though, the counterclaims wherein the answer the attorney filed the day before trial.
That there's no question about that, Judge. And that followed her retaining Mr. Enslin on November the 15th, being assured, don't worry, Holly, this is a paraphrase, Judge, don't worry, I'm going to take care of this. I'm going to get a continuance of the trial. You don't need to attend the pretrial, so nobody attends the pretrial. It's also curious to me, Judge, that Mr. Hanke, attorney for the respondent, served the motion in limine, not on Ms. Brown, but on Mr. Enslin, and then comes in here to suggest to you that Ms. Brown hasn't done anything. She didn't respond to the motion in limine. Of course she didn't respond in the motion in limine, because it wasn't served upon her. It was served upon Mr. Enslin, who put it wherever he put it and utterly did not respond to it. So Holly Brown here is a victim of a drive-by shooting. She's told not to go to the pretrial, not to do this. I'm going to get a continuance. Nothing happens until virtually the eve of trial, and none of that fault should be attributed to her, I respectfully submit. Now, another irregularity that I want to point out to, I'm talking quick because of the finite amount of time, the mechanics lien statement, judges, asked for a recovery of 20,000 some odd bucks, for brevity purposes, 20 grand. Ask yourself, how did this case turn into a $20,000 mechanics lien? And then at the end of a trial on the merits, it turns into $60,000. It just does not pass the legal smell test to me, Your Honors. And that's another irregularity. And for the record, I think it just very important to cite the Merles holding, the Supreme Court holding in Merles. The pre-lien notice is no mere technicality. Failure to give the notice defeats the mechanics lien. There must be strict compliance with the pre-lien notice statutory requirements. The Court of Appeals correctly held that the trial court erred in dismissing the pre-lien notice as a technicality which should be overlooked. The pre-lien notice, quote, shall, unquote, be set out in any written construction contract. Here it was not, but apparently the parties assume the construction company could have complied with the statute by serving a separate pre-lien notice within 10 days after reaching an agreement. The unusual feature of this case is that it is unclear what the construction company is claiming it did or did not do with respect to the pre-lien notice. Other than an equivocal assertion that it served a pre-lien notice, the construction company offered no proof that it had. It presented no affidavit of personal service or proof of service by certified mail, nor does the notice itself or a copy thereof appear in the record. Is to avoid this, quote, yes, I did, no, you didn't, unquote, kind of dispute that the statute expressly prescribes the manner in which the pre-lien notice is to be given in view of the denial in defendant's answer. This is not proof that it was. On this record, the construction company never established compliance with the pre-lien notice requirement, entitling it to a mechanics lien. I submit that is smack on point, and Holly Brown, that the pre-lien notice and the remedies available, mechanics lien ought to be reversed, in this case remanded, so that Holly Brown is entitled to a new trial on the real merits of the case, not based upon a motion in limine that excluded all of her evidence. Thank you for the additional time and your patience and attention, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments today and your briefs. The case